Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Guys, this is Succession. This is HBO. If you don't want to hear me talking about Logan Roy, talking about then don't listen to this. There are bad language words in this show. Hello, and welcome to, I guess, what we have to call the Succession episode of Slate Money Succession. It has been 3.5 seasons, but we finally find out who takes over from Logan Roy. I am Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hello.
I'm here with Elizabeth Spires of the New York Times and other many places.
Hello.
And very excitingly, we are here with the one and only friend of the pod, Mr. Michael Beirut. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. You have come on for various different types of episodes over the years, but introduce yourself and tell us about your Succession mania.
I am I'm a partner in a firm called Pentagram, where I do brand consulting and graphic design of all kinds. I have probably over the course of my career had, you know, 500 different people serving as clients to my work, and all of them are represented in every episode in one form or another. So, just like Tom keeps saying, I only seek to serve, and I've ended up serving all sorts of people. So I watch it sort of with a ghoulish sort of fascination, like we all do. So
this is amazing. You can help to distinguish between Hugo and Carolina. This is a relationship which we have been, what's the word, speculating about on this show quite a bit. But Emily, this is the episode that you loved, right? And it's also the episode where we get a new proper actual CEO or co-CEOs,
yes,
of Waystar Royco.
Yes, this episode, first of all, takes place the day after Logan dies, and they're all out looking to work the angles in Logan's house. It's like, it's all about who takes over. There's a little bit of mourning in the beginning of the episode. They show the three kids kind of like laying around. Oh, and drop the bomb news that Shiv is pregnant, by the way.
Before the titles.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the coronation demolition derby, as she says. So the whole episode is, you know, vying for power in this aftermath. Like, the king is dead. Who's going to be the next king? It's totally unclear. There's a wonderful scene in the kitchen where Jerry, Frank, and Carl are kind of like trying to work their magic. And Tom, but he's casually dismissed. But yes, the whole episode is about this board meeting. Who's gonna be up to be the CEO? And it is delicious in all the ways we love Succession to be.
In terms of continuity, like, it is fascinating what they show and what they don't show. But like, we never actually see the board meeting, right? We just kind of see Stewie barging in quasi uninvited to like the pre-board meeting, and effectively, single-handedly, just coronating Roman and Kendall as co-CEOs. And at that point, it's a done deal. We don't even need to see the actual board meeting.
Right. That's like so many things. The pre-meeting is where everything gets decided before the meeting, where you just, you know, pro forma say what you're going to say, but it's all happened already. That's how it works, right, Michael?
Well, I think actually when I'm gone to these like high stakes meetings, almost the criteria for success is that everything's been decided beforehand, mm-hmm. that nothing of there'll be no surprises, there'll be nothing of real import, that everything's been brought together. Sometimes at considerable expense and inconvenience to the participants to sort of sit through a thing that has a preordained outcome. And not only is that not frustrating or boring for people, it's sort of seen as just as it should be in a way. So
I'm reminded actually of my cousin Thomas. We had him on the show a few years ago talking about the Salmon family when we had a company that we controlled but was still a public company and needed board meetings. And there would always be a meeting of the Salmon family the day before the meeting of the board meeting of the company, where everything was actually decided at the meeting of the Salmon family. And it's interesting that at various points in the episode, Shiv talks about having a message from her mom. Greg talks about how he's talked to Uncle Ewan. Like, clearly there are other members of the family who would like to be involved in those discussions, but they're just not there. And like, physically being there turns out to be the thing that actually matters most.
Yes, because some of the most important conversations, obviously the conversation between Kendall, Roman, and Shiv, but also between Kendall and Stewie, that was basically the pivotal conversation where, and let's unpack that a little if we want to skip ahead.
This is Slate Money Succession. We want.
Yeah, we want to unpack. So Kendall basically, they have this interesting conversation where at first it's personal and there's hugging and an exchange of insults. And then, you know, he makes this play for Stewie's support. And when Stewie says, "What's in it for me?" Kendall just says, "Helping out an old friend." And that seems to have worked. Thoughts? Elizabeth.
Yeah, it seemed out of character for Stewie to just go, "Okay." Which, you know, didn't literally happen, but he seemed to, that seemed to be enough. And I, for me, they hadn't really established that he and Stewie were that close. So it was a little confusing for me.
Well, I mean, we've had, their relationship has been tumultuous over the course of this show. And they've been very close and they've been very far apart at various different points over the seasons. But it has always been clear that they go back a long way. And, you know, and so on some level, there's that one line where, is it Frank or Carl? Like, basically turns to Stewie looking at this fait accompli that he's implemented basically and says, "You just want to be the puppet master." And I think if you want an answer to your question, Emily, that's the answer, right? That Stewie reckons he's going to have more control over Ken than he would over, say, Jerry, which is probably true.
Everyone kind of keeps simultaneously behaving as if this is a really crucial, consequential decision that will be a long-lasting one, while all simultaneously saying, "This is just interim, get the deal done, then I'll be out." And everyone sort of says, "Put me in charge because I won't be there that long." There's a lot of that going on. And so I think Stewie, like everyone else, is sort of thinking this is just one move on the chessboard, but not the final one. And there'll be, you know, I think everyone is just trying to figure out what gives them the most favorable terms for future maneuvering in a way. After all, there are going to be six more episodes.
Right. I mean, the old guard is basically like, I think it's Carl who says, like, I almost bought this house in on a Greek island or something. And like, Kendall's just going to screw it up. Like, he's not going to land this deal. And like, it's all going to fall apart, which I share that concern.
Yeah. I mean, if I were Stewie and purely motivated by money, and I really wanted the deal to happen, I would put in someone whose job was clearly to sell the company and who was answerable to the non-family shareholders, who didn't have any like emotional, you know, shit tied up in the company. I mean, like, Stewie knows, because he's not dumb, that all three of the kids were violently opposed to selling this to doing this deal not so long ago at the end of season three, right? They're all now paying lip service to the idea that they've changed their mind and they want to do the deal. But like, if you're going, if your main thing is I want to do the deal, then you don't put in charge two people who were violently opposed to it just a few weeks ago.
And who have like an interest and who have had an interest over the past 4 years, if not obviously longer, in running their father's, yeah, in running their father's company. Like, it's just too tempting. And by the end of the episode, you have Kendall, you know, going behind Roman's back and like doing his dad a dirty and, and, you know, to set up this like PR campaign to basically smear him after he's dead. Like, it's just, even if they're telling the truth and they want to do this deal, like, they don't want to. They want to see if they can do dad's job, right?
Well, they all assume that the interim designation is not real, that, you know, once they're in the seat, they get to stay there if they, you know, make the right moves.
So, Elizabeth, are you saying that Roman and Kendall clearly don't want to do the deal?
No, I think the deal is kind of ancillary to what their ambitions are. I think now that they're in the CEO seat as co-CEOs, their priority is to stay there. So whatever allows them to do that, I think is, you know, the move that
they
would make.
So when you say that, when you say stay there, like, do you mean beyond staying there as head of like ATN Pierce and doing the, you know, running that media company that they said they want to run?
Yeah, I don't think they have any intention of just being interim CEOs.
Yeah, but they will, like, if they do the deal, they become the permanent CEOs of ATN Pierce, mm-hmm. right? That's the plan. The question is, like, what I'm asking you is, when you say they don't have any intention of just being interim CEOs, do you mean they don't have any intention of being interim CEOs of Waystar Royco and all of the theme parks and the cruises and the film studios and everything else? Or is it just, you know, which one is it? Did they want to actually scuttle the deal or not?
I don't think they do now. I think it you know, makes a difference that Logan is actually gone. You know, they've hinted all the way through the season that they had trouble sort of wrapping their heads around the idea that Logan was ever going to leave. And so now all of them are ambitious in their own way. All of them have wanted to be in charge of the company at some point. So for me, it just makes sense that now that Kendall and Roman are in that seat, they'll do whatever it takes to stay there.
Michael, what do you think?
I was wondering, during one of my favorite scenes, which is the when they call back the Swede and attempt to have a conference call, and they're talking to his assistant, Oscar, I believe. And they're just that choreography of expressions, faces, and everything, as there's that weird moment where it's sort of unclear whether they actually know that, that Logan died, you know, because they're not getting sort of the right sort of cues from
Oscar,
from the assistant, yeah. From Oscar. Yeah. It's sort of like, tough. It was tough that he says, well,
that was tough.
tough day. Yeah. And, but I wonder, had they gotten through, what were they going to say? And I guess what they're going to say is, we're in charge now and you'll deal with us and we'll get back to you in a week, which is how it ended, maybe. But I don't think they sort of know what I think the kids really do sort of all seem to possess this common trait where they're unable to see anything except the next step. And the next step now is just sort of making sure that they're in charge. And then after that, you know, who knows?
They definitely made it clear that the original timeline, which is basically that the deal gets signed tomorrow, is off. Yeah. And they're like, no, we're burying our dad, like, get real. And it seems that Lucas Madsen has understood that very well, because he's gone and, you know, scheduled his annual retreat for when he was meant to be signing this deal.
Which can't be changed. It's the annual retreat, change that.
So, although, like, clearly, I think, as of episode one of this show, that annual retreat was not scheduled for this time, right? Because of episode one, they were going to be signing the deal that day.
Yeah,
it's wild, that kind of power move. And it's not obvious how the degree to which the kids actually like have grokked that and understand how much of a play it is. But he's clearly making some kind of a play. And it's not obvious what play he's making, right? Yeah. It's not obvious to, like, is he changing his mind, or is he like just preserving optionality? Like, he's waiting to see. He's seen obviously the Waystar Royco share price fall. Is he waiting to see whether he can get a better deal by just waiting a little bit and watching things burn a little bit longer?
Don't you think he'd rather deal with anyone as opposed to Logan, who I think was at least kind of formidable and was bringing sheer force of will into the situation, even though it did seem like, you know, they're separated in style by generations and a kind of a mutual lack of kind of understanding of that perhaps. But then I think my guess is that he sort of would think that the longer he waits, it's just going to get more and more and more favorable for him. Correct? It can't go otherwise.
That's what I think. I mean, he really has two options: to do the deal at the price he agreed on, or do the deal at a lower price, or not do it at all.
Yeah.
And things are in play, so it makes sense that he would sort of not pay that original price because the company is now worth less than it was before Logan died.
Presumably that alone suffices to explain why Sandy and Stewie have gone very quiet about their idea of trying to get the price up.
Yeah, oh, that's like off the table, right? And no one's talking about that. That's over.
Which is weird, right? Because like in principle, nothing has changed in terms of the assets that Mattson is buying.
Yeah, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's more like a plot device almost, because now it's like everything depends on Kendall and Roman's ability to land the plane. What does he say? It would be a feather in my... Kendall says it would be a feather in my cap if I can make this deal or something.
And actually, you know, there is that one scene between Shiv and Tom where Shiv is like it's my fault that Dad died, basically. That I think probably she speaks on some like emotional level for all three of them when she clearly deeply regrets having pushed him to try and renegotiate the deal and get a better price. And his death has just kind of placed this pall over that entire idea, and no one is committed to it even anymore. Not even, you know, Sandy Jr.
Yeah.
Oh my God, but Sandy Sr. turns up. We didn't see him all last season, and now he turns up in a wheelchair. Doesn't get any lines.
No, but he's quoted though. What is he? Yeah. What's attributed to him?
Why is everyone so sad at the sex party?
Why is the sex party so sad?
No, it's a good question.
Presumably that's a tip of the hat to old Sumner Redstone.
Yes. Yeah. A lover of sex parties. An attendee at sex parties.
Who among us doesn't love the occasional sex party? Yeah.
I mean, it's better than whatever that was at Logan's house. I guess it was Awake, where the presidential candidate was coming in and people were making speeches. I mean, what kind of crazy Wake was that? Is that what a Wake is like? I don't know.
Yeah, that like beardy guy who I always think of as being like Grover Norquist. Just standing up and trying to, I don't know, gather the troops and doing clearly quite a bad job of it. Everyone seems to be rolling their eyes.
Potter says something like, they're trying to body snatch her dad.
There was, through the whole episode, there was this motif of people kind of seeking to characterize someone else in very specific terms. And that was an example of it. He was going to get up and say, you know, Logan Roy was a giant figure in the conservative movement, and everyone's rolling their eyes. But then you even had, who is it that says, you know, the kids could take over, but they're screw-ups and dipshits.
Tom,
and then yeah. I think Frank says, or you might say that they're just simply constitutionally unprepared at this moment to accept the whatever, you know. And then there's, I think Frank is talking to Tom and says something like, well, let me see if I could just kind of play out a scenario of how you might be viewed. And then it goes into that long speech about, you know, you're a hanger on and you sort of like, you know, you're the only person who liked you is dead and you're married, you're getting divorced from, you know, from his daughter and she never liked you anyway. And, you know, and sort of like, it's always like people just kind of putting whatever spin on. And then, of course, ends at the very end with the ultimate sort of, you know, the plot device that's unleashed by Kendall with Hugo sort of tweaking or re-spinning the, you know, the press about his late father and just sort of saying, well, you know, why don't we go with option two, but no fingerprints and, you know, but like actually just doing, you know, posthumous character assassination, basically.
That's a really good point. There is the theme running through the whole episode of like, Logan's legacy is being written right now in real time. And there's this great scene with the kids, the three kids, where they're looking at the obituaries. And they do translations. So he says, he was a complicated man. And then Kendall says, threw phones at staff, sharp reader of the national mood, very racist, man of his era,
also racist.
So good. And that does run through the whole thing. Like this is, and I think Connor even literally says it, like history is being written right now.
Yeah.
Connor has that wonderful line as well, where he's like, he wasn't a neocon, he was a paleo-libertarian.
What does that mean? Does it mean you only eat raw foods and you don't believe in taxes? I didn't understand what a paleo-libertarian
was. He was practically an anarcho-capitalist. But I mean, in a weird way, like, you know, obviously Connor is ridiculous, but he's half right. Now, you know, at some point we should like write Logan's obituary a little bit. Logan definitely has the Murdochian ability to let the winds blow him where they're moving, like to be able to support both Tony Blair and Donald Trump. You know, like he wasn't an ideologue, but insofar as he had a sort of belief in anything, like I do think that sort of paleo-libertarian and practically anarcho-capitalist are right. Like he's just like law of the jungle, right? Yeah. And I am going to just go out there and roar more loudly than anyone else, and I'm going to take over, and I have the most money, and therefore I get to make the rules. And that was really about as far like as his sort of personal ideology went. This episode of Slate Money is brought to you by Wondery, which is a podcast company, and it makes a podcast called The Best One Yet, and it is a daily podcast hosted by Nick and Jack, who serve up three of the most interesting business news stories every day and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisitions like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? That's the kind of stuff you find on The Best One Yet. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
I think we need to talk about Marsha because she's back. We haven't seen her.
Oh my
since
god!
The last season, was, right? Like, since she was shopping forever.
I was so happy when I saw Marsha there, and that wonderful exchange with Ken at the very beginning, where Marsha's like, "Sorry for your loss," and Ken is like, "Thank you. Likewise."
Likewise, I'm sure. Yeah.
Ken is all of us. Like, she's back. What? Yeah. What? What
and
happened?
And by the way, I want to note that people complain no deals ever get made. Marsha managed to sell that apartment right there,
Marsha,
in the foyer.
Marsha should be like a high-end real estate agent. Seriously, like she has this utterly discombobulated Connor in front of her who has no idea what numbers even are. And before he knows it, he's buying the house for $63 million.
I thought she could have gotten more because she said between 60 and 70. He said 63. You're never supposed to take the first offer.
She obviously started at like way higher than she wanted to sell. And then he came in at that ridiculously high range and she's like, fine, done. She was expecting to sell for like 45.
She could have gotten 64 is all I'm saying.
No, 65. Because no, what she did, this is a genius thing. What she did was, like, she took Connor's genuine confusion and turned it into an offer. Like, Connor said, like, 63, he wasn't saying, I would be willing to pay 63. He was just saying, like,
he was calculating, you know, what are numbers between 60 and 70?
Exactly.
63 would be one of those numbers, right?
Exactly. And then she sees her opening and she grabs it.
Yeah. It was, okay, she is a deal-making genius.
Yeah.
As long as they both, you know, she spits on her hand and reaches for the handshake.
That was disgusting. Would you do that? That's my question. I was like, I don't think I would do that. I would not spit and shake the spit in return. I just, constitutionally, I mean, I'm never going to be in the position of buying a $63 million townhome in Manhattan, I don't think. No spoiler there. But
Emily, in case you ever are, I should just tell you that it's pretty smart. It's pretty smart not to pay realtors' fees, and it's such a bitch to get into these big buildings.
She couldn't argue with that. She was like, "All right, yeah."
and that brought up the Carrie scene as well, which I thought was really heartbreaking.
So it's super interesting. Obviously, Carrie, and then to a much lesser extent, I would say Roman, are the people with actual emotions in this episode. But Carrie comes in clearly distraught in a way that no one else in the apartment is. Marsha has negative sympathy for her. And it's just like, what's her amazing line? We're calling her a taxi to the subway so that she can go home to her little apartment.
Yeah, I mean, she's the one person in the room that is completely stripped of power, like doesn't have even one iota of power or goodwill. Yeah. And I remember it wasn't that long ago that I was worried about how they were going to ease her either into or out of her position in the anchor chair at ATN. That seemed like it might be an ongoing sort of motif that would continue through the entire season. Now suddenly, we don't have Carrie to worry about anymore. But like it's rare where someone is like actually, you know, the bag. Again, it's one of those kind of like inappropriately large bags that she has there with her stuff in, that spills open. It's all over the place, and it just, you know, had someone been shot and bleeding on the floor, it would barely be just a little bit more shocking than just even all that detritus on the floor being cleared up and get it out of here, including her.
You know? She was talking
to Roman about, he said he was going to marry me. He was going to make it official. We were going to come out.
Is that what she said? I couldn't hear.
It was very gothic to me. It was very Edith Wharton,
Is that actually what she said, or are you kind of like reading into it?
That is what she was saying.
I need to be listening with better headphones.
Yes, you do. But obviously none of that's happening. And it has been interesting to see who is like, who has lost power without Logan. Like it's the people without alliances. Like the three siblings are in some ways loyal to each other. I mean, not really, but you know, they have bonds, and the old guard, they're sort of bonded to each other in a very weird, passive aggressive, backstabby way, but they're like a team of, they sort of respect each other. But then Tom and Greg, they really are out there.
And you see Tom kind of
grasping.
Ping ponging between all of them, trying to find, you know, his new alliance and telling all of them, you know, I'm just here to serve.
Yeah.
If there is a ring, my hat is available to be thrown into it or whatever he said.
I will be of service to whoever.
Roman's response to Tom's to Tom is absolutely amazing. He calls him lip balm Tom Wham, lubing up his lip to kiss my butt. And you're like, yeah.
Accurate.
Fair, accurate.
Riding his little subtle cycle across Niagara Falls.
But also, yeah, I mean, like, Tom is interesting here because clearly he's trying to, as you say, play all the angles and trying to get retain some kind of semblance of relevance. But there's no way that his connection to relevance and power is going to be Roman. Like, that's just simply never going to happen.
Roman's not like that.
Right.
But Kendall is. Kendall's move with Hugo is pretty amazing. It's like, it's the arc of the episode, because when Kendall walks into the townhouse, and let me just emphasize that Hugo is talking to his own daughter, and he's telling her, you fucked me in the ass. You put a strap on, what is it? You have a strap on and you fucked me in the ass. To his daughter, that's what he's saying to his daughter. I just wrote it down in my notes like three times. His daughter.
But you learn at the very, Emily, you learn that at the very end. I mean, I remember when I mean, that really struck me because it seemed sort of, you know, it was just odd that he walked in and they had another character having this side conversation. Mm-hmm. And I sort of thought it was just kind of like life goes on, you know, someone might have just died, but someone else is getting fucked in the ass with a strap on because the way it goes, baby.
He's not actually talking to her. He's leaving her a voicemail.
Yes. Yes.
Ooh,
good point.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So it turns out then that she is sold stock right before it was officially announced that Logan died. And that's not good optics, would be considered, I guess, insider trading, possibly. So he tells Kendall this, and Kendall uses it as leverage at the end to get him sort of to freelance this under the radar PR move, slamming his father. And it's just like,
weird choice of person to tell. Like, tell Jerry? Why would you tell Kendall?
There was an insinuation that Kendall had some kind of relationship with Hugo's daughter.
Really?
When they were having that conversation. Or that they knew each other somehow.
I didn't pick up on that at all. Hmm.
Yeah, that is interesting. Why tell Kendall and not Jerry? Or Carolina, your boss.
So, okay, Michael, this is where we need to bring this in.
No, I'm not walking into this trap. I don't know what the relationship in the org chart is clearly between Carolina and Hugo.
Do you understand the difference between them, though, as like the kind of people they are, the kind of jobs they have?
One appears to be a sort of, like, she's more of a communications strategist in a way, and a little bit more on the inside. Like, she sort of will set the strategy. Then Hugo, I think, is the one that actually kind of says, okay, this is what we're going to say using this kind of language, I think, which has like a slightly different, sometimes has a slightly different title. I'm not sure that one is the other's boss, but they seem to kind of like be doing two, like a little bit inside outside ends of things, which I think I heard you kind of saying last week, I think.
She's more public facing. He's more like behind the scenes.
Oh, really? I sort of was interpreting it the other way around.
Really?
But maybe that's just, yeah,
I just
don't know.
Based on like how they present, he seems more like, you know, lurking behind the scenes.
Oh, I think my read of it is that Carolina is more of a sort of Waystar Royco executive, and Hugo is more of, he works more for the family. He was like Logan's guy.
Yeah. He would be the one who could go get, you know, go get some Advil or something.
Insofar as there's like a distinction between Logan's interests and Waystar's interests, you know, I would say that Carolina would come down on the side of Waystar while Hugo would come down on the side of Logan.
Hugo would come down on the side of Hugo.
Yeah. But Felix, I think you're right, and I think it's easy to sort of forget because very few people live like this, and most other people don't come into contact with these sort of scenarios. But for these really wealthy people, it's really common for there to be, you know, at least two structures, kind of a corporate public-facing structure, and then quote-unquote the family office. And if you have that kind of wealth, you know, the things that are sort of the tasks that are undertaken and the staff you require to run the family office can be just as, you know, can be the size of a medium, you know, medium large enterprise for anyone else with, you know, multiple staff and all these people scurrying around doing things. And what's weird is that it's completely, you know, all those people have one client basically, which is the family. They have one job, which is to keep the family happy. And yet they sort of, they'll have desks and business cards and like that the family office will have an official name that kind of functions as the financial entity that's kind of commissioning the plane rides and kind of taking out the mortgage on the office and paying for the hotel for the family retreat and all this other stuff. And it's sort of just like a shadow company that requires, you know, that has no real public audience at all.
Also, a listener emailed us, I should say, a few days ago and reminded all of us that in a previous season, Hugo tried to get Carolina fired. He was talking to Logan and just suggested it. And he said something like, "You nasty move," or I don't remember the exact language, but there was a mutual recognition of their slipperiness and willingness to backstab in that moment.
Emily, it's real connoisseurship, by the way, to be, you know, to really be kind of doing this sort of analysis of sort of the second and third string. like the hoi polloi out there is just kind of like, you know, following the lead actors. But to really go down to that level, I think, I mean, to me, I find that whole structure of Carl, Frank, Jerry, Hugo, Carolina, all really, really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that kitchen scene, I just...
Yeah, it's amazing. It's
so what does good. He say? Does anyone want to have a look at the china? I highlighted it. So good. Oh, yeah. Would anyone care for a look at the china? They all kind of sidle into the kitchen. And
the way that it's constantly signaled, you know, who's going to be in the room, who's going to be out of the room. And it's, you know, so... And just so... It strikes me as so funny and weird and clear that even at this moment, when it comes time to talk about the business and it's the four kids, Connor's told, you know, thanks, we're going to have to handle this. And he says, Mikasa es su casa. Pride of his new home, you know, by all means, right?
As Matt Levine says on Bloomberg all the time, seating plans are everything. Like everything is about who is in which room at which time. There's this fascinating and absolutely real distinction between upstairs and downstairs. That, you know, downstairs is a quasi-public area where almost anyone can turn up, you know, whether you're a presidential candidate or, you know, the Secret Service's dog or Kerry or anyone. Upstairs is the much more of the sanctum sanctorum where you need to be very, you know, important and or family. But even Connor doesn't make it upstairs. Yeah. Greg, like, because just by sheer obliviousness, does actually go upstairs and gets told that he is an addendum of miscellaneous matters in pencil with a question mark. Which...
And Greg's immediate reaction is that Logan wanted him to be number two in the company.
And everyone literally bursts out laughing. But yeah, but then Stewie does this incredible power play where he's like, I know I don't belong upstairs. You know, he had no real relationship with Logan. They were adversaries. But he just like barges in to the room and... The execs are like, wait, no, you're not meant to be here. And the kids are like, nah, he can be here. And then that is the power play right there, right? The actual real decision as to who gets to take over the company is all played out in this conversation of, is Stewie even allowed upstairs?
And when he's allowed in, it's sort of game over, at least this round, right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, there's like, you know, everyone else becomes completely irrelevant, whether it's Caroline or Ewan or Peter Munion, who's sending texts to Connor saying, it's a rum situation and one in the eye for all of us.
That's British talk, I believe, right, Felix?
I don't understand it, but it's...
I mean, I say such things to Emily all the time.
And I don't understand what he's saying, but I smile.
At Evernorth Health Services, We believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Can I ask a question that you may all know this already, but who's the dad of Shiv's?
Oh, yeah. Let's get into it. Yeah, Michael. Yes. Who is the dad? Who is,
I don't want to get all kind of gothic and gossipy, but
the Shiv pregnancy thing is we should definitely talk about that a bit more because number one, it helps to answer the question of the elasticated pants in episode one.
And her general dishevelment. And her general dishevelment.
Number two, I think it helps to explain the speed with which she rolled over to her two brothers taking over the company, because she was doing the mental math and they were saying, we're going to be in charge for 6 to 8 months. And she's like, yeah, on a 6 to 8 month time horizon, I'm going to be having a baby. I don't want to be trying to be co-CEO and having a baby at the same time. This is just going to be a shit show. And I feel like she was realistically speaking, the timing of this baby has really kind of put the kibosh on me being the CEO. She makes a half-hearted play, but she knows it's not going to work.
She's angry though that she's being blocked out. The scene where she stumbles toward the end and gets very angry when people are trying to help her.
She is a mess.
When they did the, what I thought was a fairly kind of gutsy, jaw-dropping, we're 1 minute in, and just when you thought there's no more surprises to be had, they sort of let us off easy on this episode, they spring another one on you right before the title song starts up. The conversation she has with her OBGYN makes it sound like it could have been scripted a completely different way, which is, we got the results and you definitely are pregnant. Oh no. Or she could be in the bathroom and discover it, But instead, this is obviously something that she's really been monitoring really closely. There's been multiple consultations with the doctor and, everything has come back okay. Everything looks good. And you can't tell from her face whether she's happy or sad or, what it's all about. But to me, it's, this isn't an accident. It's something that she's very,
Yeah, no, I do think it's not an accident. And to answer your question, Michael, this is why I'm 90% sure that Tom is the father. And quite possibly Tom is the father through a whole bunch of very medical procedures that they spent a lot of time working on. And, we just haven't seen. The conversations definitely kind of align with the whole sort of geriatric mother thing of, it's difficult to get pregnant at her age and there are lots of complications and you need to be on top of it and you have lots of, highly expensive medical advice and all of this kind of stuff. Tom obviously doesn't suspect, but there is in that conversation between Shiv and Tom that one line where she talks about Logan, how he might have been around for 20 more years to rock his grandkids to sleep. And Logan and Tom does not pick up on the subtext there. But that's clearly what she's thinking.
Yeah. And just to go back to what Michael was saying. So the doctor on the phone says your amnio results. And that's the tip off, she's really far along because you don't necessarily always get amniocentesis. That's a test.
Yeah, they're scheduling a 20-week scan.
Yeah, in a 20-week scan. Yeah. So amnio means there's already probably been some kind of genetic test that looked weird or prenatal test that looked weird. So they went ahead and did the amnio because it's a little of a riskier test. Or it means she's over 35, which I'm not clear that she her character is over 35 in this.
I think she is, yeah.
Yeah, I assumed it was an age thing rather than a specific worry thing. But I think also if you're that age, probably, yeah. You know, if you're that status, you just kind of use every procedure they've got available.
For yeah, you that makes sense
only
too.
The best for the Roys, you know.
But I don't know. There was the episode where she suggests freezing her eggs when Tom says he wants to have babies. So
oh, that's right. Like, they did have that whole conversation, didn't they?
Yeah, and he was like devastated by that. But this could just be a regular, like, she got pregnant kind of a thing, right? Because he obviously doesn't know about it. And it would have been 16 yeah. weeks ago. That would have been before maybe his betrayal, you know, and they stopped
right.
speaking.
Right. I think.
And are we meant to think at the end when she trips that that might jeopardize the pregnancy in some way? Because I sort of started thinking that all those, that was like Chekhov's marble staircase or Chekhov's... high heels or something, because yeah. I all of a sudden, you know, that house whenever she was moving around, it seemed much more precarious to me. That you know, and then she finally takes that spill, and I thought, oh, this could be, you know, the denouement of the, you know.
I think
it would
if
take
you wanted
more to dislodge a baby, I think.
Yeah, if you wanted so. A baby dislodging spill, then that would have had to have happened on the big staircase.
Yeah,
the,
I think so. Yeah, yeah.
That's like something in a movie from like the 1930s or something.
Yeah, baby dislodging spill.
or like, you know, Princess Diana throwing herself down the staircase in an attempt to, like, you know, I don't know what the hell she was trying to do, but yeah, Shiv is clearly, you know, again, like, amazing acting in that scene in the bed.
Can we talk about the letter? There's a piece of paper.
Oh, the piece of paper. which like just gets read by, like, it takes about 5 seconds for that piece of paper to get its way to, like, even Tom. Like, everyone knows about the piece of paper.
Yeah,
news
no,
travels first.
I have to admit, when it was being discussed, and there's a moment where there's a medium shot and the piece of paper is visible and you can sort of make out that there's some little list in the right-hand corner. And I remember thinking at the moment, you know, this is our only chance to really know what's on the piece of paper. But then a few minutes later, they're basically telling you everything that's on the piece of paper. And I thought that that whole underline versus crossing out thing was just, I mean, maybe someone might think it was too on the nose, but boy, oh boy, you know, it's sort of the last thing he looks at before he goes to Hugo to kind of like make his thing. And you can tell that he sort of is, you know, that sort of is the affirmation he's been willing to into existence his whole life. Mm-hmm. And then there it is, probably. Assuming that it does look like it's underlined rather than crossed out.
I thought it looked like it was crossed out.
Oh my gosh.
This is like the dress on BuzzFeed.
Uh-huh. So is the dress white or is it blue? Okay. Right. So it'll just depend on your own relationship with your own father, I suppose.
Oh my God. Incredible.
Wow.
Incredible. Wait, but why didn't... So Carl and Frank, they joke about, you know, maybe it could be lost, you know, just comically musing about it.
And Carl goes, I'm kidding, of course. And Frank goes, you're speculating in a humorous vein.
Yes, exactly. But why didn't they just do that? I don't understand. Are they just that inept? They're not ethical, are they? If I were them, I would have been like, we'll just put that down for now. You know what I mean? Like, no one else is going to see it.
I think, yeah, they probably, things were moving too fast.
I feel like they're just a bunch of clowns. Like,
it's
this big secret
Jerry.
That, like you said, Felix, everyone knows in a minute.
And then also, I think it's sort of, maybe as a bit of plotting, it's necessary just to tip it one more, you know, inch towards affirming that Kendall is the legitimate heir to the throne in a way, mm-hmm. You know, because absent that, it's just sort of, you know, the status quo of everyone kind of a war of all against all would just kind of continue, I suppose. And suddenly this quasi document, which also has what I think like music and things on it, songs he wants to play. That seems very sentimental for
not, not to mention the investment grade impressionist, the three Gauguins no one's ever seen for tax reasons. which is so, you know, it's so on the nose, because this is the thing, right? Like, there's the famous art collectors who are well known and sit on museum boards and that kind of thing. There is also famously trillions of dollars worth of art sitting in the Geneva Freeport, owned by, you know, big question mark. And I love the idea that Logan Roy is the kind of person who will own, you know, maybe a couple hundred million dollars worth of impressionists just sitting in the Geneva Freeport. It's kind of a little baby hedge, you know, just in case everything goes to shit, he can always go to Geneva and, you know, sell off a Gauguin. he's the kind of person. Like, the question is always, like, what kind of person buys masterpieces and locks them up in a Freeport in Geneva? And then the answer is someone who doesn't actually care about art, Logan.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember... Over the whole course of this series, I don't remember Logan ever sort of expressing pleasure or satisfaction in maybe anything. But I mean, I can't imagine him like looking at a painting and saying, oh, isn't that beautiful? Or drinking a glass of wine and saying, this is worth every penny. Or sinking into a really beautiful upholstered seat and saying, ah, you know, such comfort, you know, thank God I can afford it. He just sort of seems to be... Yeah, I mean, I just so shark-like and just constantly moving forward. And I speak of the man in the present tense, but such is his hold on everyone's imagination, I suppose. He's long gone now.
They were looking at that picture of him on the cover of the newspaper, smiling and laughing, and they're like, who's that guy?
Yeah, and I do think sort of like the last episode, too, is the, you know, the repartee that we've all come to savor is... You know, it's actually, there was like one kind of explicit moment where they're talking about Logan's newly revealed habit of calling Marcia once or twice a day. And then...
Which totally happened, 100%. I'm sure Kerry was just sitting there like listening to those conversations going, you go give her another.
And then someone, I forget who, Shiv or Kendall says, I don't want to think about what that kind of phone sex was like. And then everyone kind of looks expectantly at Roman, like Q, you know. And he says, "I'm sorry, I'm not doing a sex, a sex joke about Dad. Sorry." And he sort of shrugs and declines to take the bait, which I thought was actually a kind of bit of transparent wink, a sort of transparent wink from the writers, you know,
if we're talking about line, we should probably do like the favorite lines thing. I think no one suggested that he would fuck a child. He wouldn't even hug his grandkids is a great line.
Yeah.
Another grandkids line.
Yeah.
Just laying the foundation.
Elizabeth, do you have a favorite line from this episode?
I thought Jerry had a lot of good lines in this episode, but my favorite part was where Carl was lobbying for himself to be CEO. And she looks at him and just very devastatingly says, "Carl, I think you're a corporate legend. What you did in the 90s with cable, huge."
That was such a good line.
That was the most savage put down, much more than calling someone a dipshit, sort of praising their success with cable in the 90s.
Yeah, calling them a corporate legend. No one can survive that.
Yeah.
Devastating. There were so many good ones, but I think I enjoyed... You know, when Kendall's walking the townhouse and everyone's like, "I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm so sorry for your loss. So sorry for your loss." And then Sid says to Kendall, "Sorry, babe." I just love that.
Yeah, like the only people who are close enough to Kendall to be able to, you know, not recite the rote is his siblings, I guess, and Sid and Stewie.
Yeah.
And that does show you like how Stewie has that, how that Kendall Stewie relationship really does like drive the episode.
He made him laugh because he said something like, I heard he died after he read your business plan for Pierce.
Yeah. He choked laughing. Yeah. No, I thought that
or died fishing his iPhone from a clogged toilet.
Yeah. That may have been true actually. I could see that happening.
I thought that was true.
Towards the beginning, I thought that Roman had a classic and delivered it beautifully too. Where's Carrie? And it's like he's in Marcia's trunk, in an anaconda, in a sarcophagus. I thought that was good. And so even though he was declining to participate later on, he sort of got some good ones in anyway.
So in terms of predictions of where we're going next, Michael, you're pretty convinced that was the last we've seen of Carrie. She's not going to come back with some, you know, rattling some skeletons from Logan's closet.
No, I don't think so. I think she's meant to be us. You know, she's meant to be poor people who have no power in this world, who just has been dispatched to oblivion, basically. I'd be really surprised if she came back.
There was that amazing exchange between Marcia and Willa.
Yes.
How far you've come.
Look how far, Marcia's, look how far you've come. And Willa's like, yes, look at us both. which was so absolutely pitch perfect. But yeah, I mean, like, it was definitely conceivable that Carrie might have entered that stratospheric realm, and she just got there too late. Yeah. Emily, do you have any other prognostications for the rest of the what happens next?
I keep waiting for the siblings to kind of like have a bust up, and I possibly we're headed in that direction in the next episode, which will likely be the following day after this day. I'm obsessed with how each episode.
So Emily has this whole theory that every day is.
It's not a theory.
It is a theory, which I am going to push back on. You have this theory. So we know for a fact that every episode is confined to one day. There's no like multiple day episodes. But you also have a separate theory. And I'm 100% with you on theory number one. You also have theory number two that the entire season is basically taking place over the course of 10 days and that each episode happens the day after the previous episode.
Yes.
And I can't make that work with the way that the kids are all up in Albany at the beginning of episode two, after hanging out in like Los Angeles on episode one and going back to New York. And like, I feel like they've been hanging out in Albany for a little while. It took them a few days to get there. They would have been there for a couple of days. I don't think they hop up there just for the evening.
There is sort of the weirdness about what day of the week it is and are the markets open or aren't the markets open. They mentioned that again. The markets.
So I do think it's becoming clearer that the wedding was on a Friday and today is Saturday.
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely correct. And again, makes no sense with the stock thing. Or maybe it does.
No, it does.
Maybe they announced the death before the stock market closed.
Exactly. Because if the wedding was on a Friday, then the stock market would have been open. And that would explain why the stock market falls when everyone finds out that Logan has died.
So
that bit makes sense.
So your issue is it opens with them in California. And then the second episode, they're in New York. And you think they would have been in that New York upstate spot for longer than a day. I don't think so. They by the end of the second episode, they're already headed to New York for Connor's, rehearsal dinner.
Right, exactly. So that's the point, right? So if the rehearsal dinner...
This is really like
so
next
it's, level. If the rehearsal dinner is on Thursday, right?
Yeah.
They fly out from L.A. to New York on Wednesday night. Shiv gets in very late on Wednesday night. She wakes up Tom in their apartment on Wednesday night. And then the rehearsal dinner is Thursday night at the Four Seasons. She's not going to pop up to Albany for like the morning with her two brothers and then go back down again. It's like, when's she going to wake up? How's she going to, no, that just doesn't make any sense.
Albany is not far from
New
York City.
They don't even spend one day there.
But it's 2 hours away. I went to college there, so I'm very familiar with the trip.
What would be the purpose of like getting both of your siblings and flying them off to a farm in Albany on the day of your brother's rehearsal dinner? It doesn't make any sense. I don't buy it.
I'm just musing in a comic mode, but but I guess we should talk about bigger picture predictions, and I'll come back to you to debate further this consecutive days thing, I guess.
I just want the 100 to come back because I thought that idea had.
So what
so
did you
originally.
Think about the logos, Michael?
As a professional.
I really did. Believe me, in my circles, there were a lot of freeze framing and debating about the the logos were not great. But sort of like the hapless, mode of presentation via Zoom, where I'm going to share my screen and walk you through a deck, and I've got seven options for your logo. All of us got very used to that in, you know, the pandemic for sure. And also, you almost willed yourself to not imagine too clearly what was happening on the other end of what was happening on the audience side of the thing. You had to keep thinking everyone is rapt, they're all paying attention, they're all tracking everything I'm saying. And meanwhile, you just have some like Roman just like sprawling around saying, "That's shit, I hate that, that's stupid, what are you even thinking?" And then as they were being, you know, the thing that was most poignant to me during that presentation by the design firm, quote unquote, was they were just in the midst of saying, "Okay, then we've got your input. We're going to circle back and click." And that was sort of like, and sort of like that cheerful sort of, "Oh, we made a lot of progress with this review." And of course, you know, they'll never hear from the Roys again, and they'll follow up and they'll be ghosted and probably not even paid because that wasn't, you know, whatever happened to that thing, and that's dead and we don't care. So
Masterclass will never meet The Economist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, that idea, that's like the idea that people always have when they're regrouping, right? We're all smart. What if we pull together just nothing but smart people and offer that as an exclusive, only smart people here sort of thing, you know? And I sort of like, as a business model, it seems to be just evergreen and ever, yeah. You know.
It worked for Axios.
Yeah. True.
Elizabeth, do you have any predictions?
Well, I think last week I predicted that Kendall would be the last person standing, but there's so much misdirection in Succession that, you know, yeah, the end of this episode.
If he's standing in episode 4, there's no way he's going to be standing in episode 10.
Yeah, yeah. So now I just have no idea.
That's probably the safest, smartest way to go. Just who knows? No,
Felix, I'm actually very haunted a little bit by your question about Carrie. You know, sort of that's the ultimate misdirection, right? If she somehow, you know, maybe she comes back and runs everything.
Somebody on Twitter suggested she might be pregnant. Like whenever she looked really unhinged after Logan died.
Yeah. I think by the laws of drama, multiple people can't be pregnant. Only one person.
I agree.
Yeah, we've now officially achieved our quota of pregnancies. We will be back on Saturday with a regular Slate Money, and then just 2 days later, next Monday, we'll be back for episode 5 of Slate Money Succession. Many thanks to Patrick Fort for producing, and very many thanks to Michael Beirut. You are a superstar. We love having you on the show. Come back anytime you want. Thank you.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.